If you're listening in real time, it's the end of another really long, consequential week in Atlanta, in Georgia, in American politics. And I just hope the panel that is assembled here today, this all-star panel, has the energy to keep moving forward and talk about everything that's on our plate today. Thank you for joining us in one of our final live shows of 2019. A little later in the show, I'm going to tell you a bit about our schedule for the next couple of weeks. But a lot of you out there getting ready for Christmas. Hanukkah starts on Sunday night. So really a great holiday season. Let me get right to the panel, and then we'll start talking issues. Of course, Jim Galloway is my partner on Mondays and Fridays on Political Rewind, and he is here today. He's the lead political writer for the AJC and oversees the Political Insider blog. First of all, do you get any rest during the holiday? Are you gonna? Is the Insider shut down?
The morning jolt will resume on January 2nd.
Oh, you must feel good about that.
I do.
All right. And the other note about you is we always like to get just a little preview of what your Sunday column is going to be. It'll be online or may already be posted.
Oh, it's already
online.
Up there. Yeah, it's already
what
up there.
What can people read?
Well, Governor Brian Kemp has 4 weeks to decide whether Georgia is going to continue a 40-year tradition of accepting international refugees.
This is based on a new policy put in place by the Trump administration,
right? It was announced September 26th with a 90-day deadline. Somebody decided it wasn't a good idea to have Christmas Day as that day, as the days for deciding whether you're going to slam the door shut on immigrants. So he's got until mid-January.
All right, so I don't want to get into a long discussion about it, but as long as we're talking about it at all, the policy is put in place to force cities to go on record?
No. What it does, it will send no refugees anywhere without the active consent of a local official and the governor, which means the governor of every state in the union has veto power over whether refugees come into their states or not.
Do you get, as long as we're talking, Michael Thurman, the CEO of DeKalb County, longtime elected official in Georgia, I'll be glad to give you your credentials a little more formally, but as long as we're talking about this, do the county leaders weigh in on this as well, or is this strictly a municipal decision?
On yesterday, our Board of Commissioners unanimously adopted a resolution stating what we, DeKalb County, are very proud of. We are an opening county. We have thousands of refugees living and contributing in our county. Clarkston is really the capital of relocation in our state, and we're going to continue on that vein of being opening and welcoming. This is what and who we are and should be as Americans.
All right. Thank you for that. Amy Steigerwald is with us. She's a professor of political science at Georgia State University. We haven't seen you in a while. Glad to have you back. You have been off picking interns for the legislative session, right?
We have. We've got a total, I think, now of 50 that are coming in next year. They'll start bright and early on January 8th, and so we're looking forward to it.
And they come from universities all over the state, is that
they
right?
They do. In fact, we've got our first students ever coming in from Savannah State. We've got students from Clarkston, Valdosta. We've got people, obviously, UGA, West Georgia, North Georgia, all over. Reinhardt, trying to think. I'm sure I've left some out, but we're pretty excited.
It's a great experience for them. I wonder, Sam Olens, who is also with us, if they realize exactly what they have in store for them being down at the Capitol during a legislative session.
I think they do, and I think they greatly enjoy it.
Yeah. Sam Olens is the former Attorney General of the state of Georgia. He was longtime commission chair of Cobb County, and now is an attorney at Denton's, the world's largest law firm. Do either of you want to comment on the refugee question before we move on to something else? If you don't, that's fine. I just thought I'd give you a chance to weigh in. Sam?
So I have no disagreement with anything Michael Thurman said.
Okay. All right.
I'm pro-refugee.
All right. The deadline is now, you said, into January.
January 17.
Okay. We already know, by the way, that the mayor of Atlanta, Keisha Bottoms, has already said she will accept refugees. But here's the other quick thing, and I keep saying we'll move on, but as long as we've talked about it, it's worth a couple more minutes. The Trump administration has set an extremely low number, like 40,000, I think.
No, far lower than that. During the Obama years, it was 90,000 a year into the United States. This fiscal year, the cap is 18,000.
18. Yep. I didn't know it had dropped that far. All right. Let's move on. Jim Galloway, while you've got the ball, let me start with you on this. So we've been following throughout this week another action in federal district court, Fair Fight Action, Stacey Abrams' group that has been dealing with voter integrity issues for quite some time, since the 2018 election, actually. They've sued to stop the Secretary of State's office from dropping from the voter rolls some 300-plus thousand Georgians, or people, because some of them may no longer be Georgians. The real crux of the matter has not been that largest number of 300 plus thousand. It's been a group of maybe half of that.
120.
Based on losing their registration on the so-called use it or lose it provision that the state now employs. Correct?
Right, right. As I understand it, the state last year kind of upped the number of years you have to not use it to 9 years, but this is a group of grandfathered in people who are going to lose it after seven years.
Yeah.
So Fair Fight is going to has gone to court to block that. The judge on Monday went ahead and told the state you can go ahead and purge those 309,000, but there was going to be a hearing on the merits on Thursday, and the judge had been given assurances that that anybody in dispute could be restored upon his order. We get to Thursday's hearing, and 2 hours before Thursday's hearing, and the Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger announced that there are 22,000 people that they are automatically, unilaterally adding back into the voter registration pool because they had been incorrectly deleted.
Yeah, Amy, Fair Fight Action immediately called this a victory, and I suppose it is. They got the Secretary of State's office to review these 22,000, and we could get into the weeds so quickly here in terms of time frames for how long you've got to have gone without voting or having a communication with the Secretary of State's office. But without getting into the weeds, they basically put them in a position where they thought maybe we should go back and look at who we're eliminating.
Yes, and I will try not to be too wonky on this, but taking the time there. But I think one of the issues that comes into this and where Fair Fight was really sort of going into court is that part of the issue is that it is difficult to determine where exactly people fall on this, to determine how long it has been. There's also concerns about how it is that people are being notified and how they also then have to respond and what that time frame is. And I think, you know, Fair Fight Action's point is that the sort of identification of this 22,000 sort of suggests, well, wait a second, let's slow down and make sure that these are all really people who should be put on this list and that are, you know, not here or are not using it, et cetera.
Okay, so those 22,000 have been restored. Judge Jones did not hasn't decided the rest of the case. But one thing, Sam Olin, said that the judge did say yesterday is essentially that he is a federal judge. There's only so far he can go in interfering. I'm not sure that would be the word he chose, but it's a similar word, with what a state is doing with its voting records.
No, absolutely. And look, Judge Stephen Jones is very sharp. He's from Mike Thurman's Athens area. And a very, very good judge, a great judge, Northern District of Georgia. And I think he was correct that there is an issue about how far it's a federal issue as compared to a state issue. I think the fact that he said it, candidly, doesn't really bode well for the plaintiffs in the case.
Probably not. But, you know, Mike, here's the thing for me about this. I try to follow this, given that I have to host this show every day. But sometimes I find myself, as I said, getting into the weeds. The larger picture is, as long as this is in the news, it raises again questions that many people across the state may have about the integrity of our elections.
It does, and it's a continuation of the 2018 gubernatorial race, let's be clear, and a prelude to maybe the 2022 race. And it raises a concern to me is that the burden should be much higher on the state or any entity who seeks to remove citizens from the voting rolls. It's a huge challenge oftentimes to get people to register and or participate. So if, in fact, we take this very serious step to remove a person from eligibility, it should be done after and only after all steps are exhausted to ascertain as to whether or not they fall within a group where people haven't been participating. What the return of the 22,000 suggests to me, and it's what Amy articulated, that this is not a black and white, easily discerned determination as to who voted and who didn't. And I have great faith. I won't agree with Sam Olin. The right judge has this case, because one thing I'm convinced and very confident with is that Judge Steve Jones, to his best ability, will issue a fair decision.
I heard everything you said. One aspect of it that I think we should clear up. You said it's hard to get people to register and to vote. We do now have basically automatic registration in Georgia, right?
And to vote.
And to vote, but registration now is a given.
Right, right.
Okay, I just want to clarify that.
And the other point that we need to make here is that states are obligated to cull their rolls and to make sure that their those rolls are accurate and up to date. We have had in Georgia dead people voting.
Right.
That's not a good thing. It's the aggressiveness with which you go after those names that you think ought not to be on there. And I would think that if Mr. Thurman and other Democrats might say that a Republican Secretary of State has an incentive to be very aggressive in this.
And Bill, one thing, there are people who don't have or not qualified to seek a driver's license. So where there's automatic registration from some categories of the population, there are others who may not seek or may not qualify for a driver's license.
Enough.
So
yeah.
They exist as well.
Yeah. Amy, the governor's office listened to our conversation about this subject on Monday and sent me a link to the Brennan Center for Justice, which is, how would you characterize Brennan Center?
Definitely left-leaning.
Left-leaning.
But very supportive of broad voting rights and protections.
They sent a link which said, in which the Brennan Center said that they gave some praise to the Georgia legislature for correcting some of the problems that voter rights advocates had raised in 2018.
Well,
and I just want to make that clear.
Yeah, and I think that's maybe one of the interesting things about this particular lawsuit is it's not actually against necessarily the culling of the voter rolls. It's the fact that the legislature just passed a law which said we're now going to extend this period of inactivity before you would be purged.
Right.
That doesn't go into effect until January 1. There's a group right now that the next, whatever that is, like 7 days or 10 days, wherever we are, I don't know what day it is anymore. Sorry. Grades were due yesterday. I'm completely lost count of everything else in life. But because of that, and so that's really what they're saying is like, look, if you were doing this, whatever it would be, 10 days later, this 120,000 people wouldn't be purged. And so part of their suit is to say, like, let's follow what the legislature did. Let's extend that period. But we're not really fighting the sort of purge overall.
And Bill, let's not look at this in isolation. There has been a national ongoing effort, primarily by the Republican political leaders all across this nation, to restrict and prohibit access to the voting booth. And it's clear, and it's not just Georgia, but you have to calculate and include what is happening in surrounding states, beginning with the elimination of Section 5 voting rights protections and an ongoing effort. I mean, this is just politics. It's not good government. At the end of the day, this is about power and access and who votes and who doesn't, and ultimately influences the outcome of elections.
Sam?
Boy, was that a partisan statement. Section 5 was removed because the Supreme Court...
Sort of, kind of.
No, 100%. Because the U.S. Supreme Court stated you have to update the rules upon which Section 5 is based because, you know, life isn't the same in 2015 as it was in 1965. And Congress saw fit, even when the Democrats were in control, to not pass such legislation. So I think it stretches legal construct to relate it to 2015. I'd also suggest that old-time Democrats in Georgia have no pride with their past actions towards minorities for decades at a time. There's plenty of evil history to go around from both parties.
So what of course, what Sam Olens is referring to, Mike, is 65, the Voter Rights Act is passed, and among other provisions, it establishes preclearance, which means the Department of Justice has to weigh in, has to approve any change that relates to voting in a certain number of states based on
Nine.
Their past history of discrimination, prejudice that was could be proven, and Georgia was one of those states. Supreme Court, as Sam said, well, 2015 isn't 1965. We're throwing out preclearance. They did leave a path open. And in fact, we've discussed on this show the fact that John Lewis was one of the members of the U.S. House who just this past week passed a bill which would establish new criteria for preclearance that could be applied in different, under varying circumstances, wouldn't just be an ironclad commitment to a state like Georgia always having it or whatever. But I would guess you would argue things haven't changed as much as Sam would like to believe they have between 1965 and 2015.
They haven't changed as much as I would hope and pray that they have. And I agree with Sam. They are better, but quite frankly, none of us would argue that racism and sexism and anti-Semitism and other isms have been erased from the face of this state or this nation.
And look, Bill, I mean, race and politics are just so tightly linked in the South. You cannot separate them.
Yeah.
And we've got a situation in Georgia and elsewhere in the South where we have these vast demographic changes. We are going to reach 2025, 2030, and whites in Georgia are not going to be a majority. We're going to be a majority minority state, and that's the foundation of all these arguments that we're getting into over voting right now.
All right, I'd love to move on. Because that issue is going to continue to come up. We're going to watch. The Senate is very unlikely to take up the bill that passed in the House, but we'll watch to see what happens. Jim, let me start with you again on this, because I think journalists are the first folks who are going to be concerned about this. Sam Olin's successor in the Attorney General's office, Chris Carr, did something that no other Attorney General had ever, any other law enforcement official in the state had done. He brought a criminal charge against Jenna Garland, who worked for Mayor Kasim Reed in Atlanta City government, and she was charged with violating the Open Records Act. She refused for a period of time. She charged the people who worked around her to not comply with an open records request made by Channel 2 News and I think the AJC for water billing records for some key people like Kasim Reed
and his brother.
And apparently one reason she didn't want that out was because they were way in arrears on paying their water bill. Yesterday, although it was a misdemeanor, she was convicted
on two counts.
No jail time, $1,500 fine.
That was knocked down to $750 by the judge.
Yeah, but fascinating the way this unfolded.
Yeah, and let me just a footnote to this.
Sure.
Yeah, it was a fellow named Chris Carr, the attorney general, who prosecuted her. If I'm not mistaken, there was another guy, maybe Sam Olens or somebody, who made into Georgia law who made violation of Open Records Act a criminal act.
That, I'm glad you went there because I wanted to, that's where I wanted to go as well.
And candidly, the fact it's a misdemeanor is because I was told the bill was dead on arrival if I didn't agree to limit it to a misdemeanor. So the legislature made it abundantly clear to me that there would be no such provision without limiting it to a misdemeanor. You know, there was an unfortunate opinion piece in the Atlanta Journal that tried to turn it into a partisan issue. Open records, open meetings is nonpartisan. And as you'll recall, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation did a thorough investigation. As someone who previously was Attorney General, when the Georgia Bureau of Investigation gives you a file and shows you where the law was violated, your job's to, frankly, support your client and to bring those charges. So when General Carr brought those charges, it wasn't because he was Republican or Democrat. It was because the Georgia Bureau of Investigation gave him the evidence where that was the appropriate action. Had he not done that, where would we now be? That once again, the Sunshine Laws would be a joke.
Amy Steigerwald, considering how media is under attack these days, and by the way, this law does not just apply to reporters' requests for open records,
right?
It's for anyone. But of course, it is journalists who quite often are the ones who want them most. At a time when media is under attack from many quarters these days, this kind of is a blow for freedom of the press, freedom of access, for the importance of reporters being able to know what's actually going on.
Definitely. I mean, I totally agree with Sam that this is a sort of this is an issue which really has nothing to do with partisan politics. It has to do with information. It has to do with good governance. It has to do with transparency. We want to know what it is that government is spending money on. We want to know what types of actions are taking place. And I would argue that oversight and transparency is good across the board.
And I would just, you know, Sam, I'm not terribly upset that it's just a misdemeanor. You know, I don't think this is, should be, you know, I would be sad today if I thought that Ms. Garland was going to have to do any hard time in behind bars.
I think it should be fact specific.
Yeah. Oh, that's an interesting point. Have the freedom to apply it, what you think is appropriate for the violation.
Right. Where do the facts lead you?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I agree with you based on the facts, misdemeanor, but there is no other option.
I agree with the panelists, but I was interested in the defense lawyer's closing argument. And what he said was that really this is a trial about Kasim Reed, but Kasim Reed is not here. Mm. And that was a very interesting, I think, strategy because in many ways that's who or what the administration was on trial.
So essentially, I don't know if you're saying this or
no,
just
the defense lawyer. That was his.
Well, I get that.
Yeah, that was his argument to the jury.
Well, I get that. But I mean, the implication of that, of course, is that Kasim Reed was calling the plays on this one and Janet Garland was doing what his boss wanted him to do.
And that may be true. But I thought his closing was just as poor as his opening.
I mean, the
fact of the matter is you have these texts. You have testimony from a woman that worked in the watershed department that was told thou shalt not comply with the law. And he said, well, they were just joking. Well, I mean, if that's the best defense you can make, maybe you should have been in plea discussions.
Yeah. Here's the basis of this incident is look, when Kasim Reed demanded loyalty of his people, I mean, extreme loyalty. And this is a situation that we find in politics these days at every level, you know, especially at the federal level, is that that the highest price is placed on loyalty to one superior. And that takes us in some very, very unpleasant places, I think.
So we talk about open records. And Amy, I'm going to start with you, but I'd love to get Sam Olin's take on this as well. By coincidence of timing, not only was this verdict handed down the first time there's been a verdict in an open records case of any kind, guilty or innocent, at the same time, The Supreme Court of the state of Washington ruled in a case there that legislators in the state of Washington are subject to open records requests there. Why does that matter here in Georgia? Because in Georgia, the legislature is exempt from open records requests.
Yes. And of course, in the state of Washington, part of what that led to was information that there is a sitting state legislator there that has been involved with a militia group and at times plotting assassinations and other such fun things. It is, I think, of concern. I mean, especially from the reporter side, the fact that there is not open records requests right down at the Capitol means that there's information that simply is not able to be seen, right? So on the one hand, hearings are generally open. There are, when there's hearings, when there's markups, the votes on the floor. But on the other hand, is there could be other information and that has blocked it. I think the places where that's particularly come in is when there's been allegations of potential wrongdoing, ethics complaints, things like that, because again, there's not an open records.
I think their best, the legislature's best argument is when dealing with constituent services. Mm-hmm. I think that's their strongest maybe argument. Maybe Sam disagrees here.
So first of all, let me go back one step. The issue in the Washington court is they held that a legislator is an agency under the act.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the Georgia Supreme Court on numerous occasions has said no, a legislator is not an agency. I would take the position, Jim, that the issue, frankly, isn't between the constituent and the legislature. It's between those texts and emails among legislators.
And while the votes are happening.
And that's what doesn't want what folks don't want to disclose
well, Sam,
from both parties.
So the legislature – well, let me get Sam and then I'll get you Mike. So the Georgia legislature, of course, in passing the bill that you brought to them about open records, could have – included themselves in open records, right?
True. It was another one of those thou shall nots.
Right. Okay.
And still can.
Well, sure, they can. Mm-hmm. My understanding, the Georgia Supreme Court, if I'm right about this, when they, one of the times at least they ruled on this, said, we can't interfere. The legislature, this is the way the legislature voted. This is what they chose to make open and not open. Therefore, it's a legislative matter, not a judicial matter, right?
True.
Okay, Mike, go ahead.
No, only back to the text messages. There was no excuse in terms of the language that was being used. And any professional person working in communication should never have engaged in that type of communication with other employees. It's unacceptable. You can't. But what you also have, we look at it, and I know the discussion here has been from reporter open records requests. They are individuals who spend all of their days making open records requests.
Oh, yeah.
Hundreds, thousands of them, tens of thousands of pages. So where does this line, where is it drawn, and where does it become rational and unreasonable? We have two people who do nothing but respond to open records requests.
So the law specifically says that if you have someone who keeps sending requests to you, and if it's over X number of pages, you have the authority to charge them. And if they don't pay, you don't have to reply to another request until they've paid for the outstanding requests.
That's not how it works.
Well, that's what the law says.
I understand, but citizens' requests, no matter how often they make them, we respond to them because—
Well,
you know,
in your case, it's a political decision then as well, right?
Well, yes, because it will go now that, well, DeKalb didn't respond.
Right.
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 Whether it's over 10,000 pages. So you're in the position where you're a no-win proposition.
Yeah.
And that's all I'm saying.
Okay.
It's not as clear cut. As we try to make
to be
it
elected.
It is an interesting
oh, absolutely.
Conundrum. All right, look, I've let this go on longer than I probably should have because we haven't gotten to a break yet. Let's do it right now. When we come back, we've got a lot more to talk about on Political Rewind.
Yeah, I was amused.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Michael Thurman is in the house along with Sam Olens, Amy Steigerwalt, and Jim Galloway. Jim Galloway, we learned a little bit more about Kelly Loeffler, the candidate for the senator designate for the rest of Johnny Isaacson's term, and then the candidate for his seat, special election in 2020. We learned a little more about her because she gave an interview to your colleague, Greg Bluestein. I'm already in trouble because in promoting that we were going to talk about this, I said that she was anti-impeachment, anti-abortion, and pro-Trump. And we've already heard from our good friend Mark Roundtree, the Republican consultant, why do we say anti-abortion instead of pro-life? Let's stop with the word choice aspersions. If she says, anyhow, I just want to give Mark a shout out.
All right. Okay. Then we have to start using pro-choice too.
That's right. Oh, yeah. There you go. Okay.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah. yes. The rollout continues of Ms. Loeffler, and I think we are still seeing the greenhouse version, the kind of the protected climate. Candidate. She's got a specific list of talking points that she's hitting. The phrasing is pretty much straight out of the GOP handbook. So I don't think we've seen the real Kelly Loeffler yet, and I don't think we probably will until she's sworn in, probably on January 6th or 7th.
So, Amy, before I turn it over to the two gentlemen across from you, who are represent partisanship to an extent, the Loeffler rollout, the positions that she's been so clear, both in the governor's office and then in the interview with Bluestein, to establish. How do they feel to you? In other words, this is what she's supposed to say at this point, right? If, in fact, she's going to win Republican votes and head off a possible challenge from the right. In other words, how much do we take what she's saying at this point to be her true beliefs as opposed to the positioning she has to do?
I guess the question would be, is there a difference? I mean, what she has put out are statements on the record of positions that she is taking. I'm not going to sort of question whether she truly believes them or not, but I do think there is something to the reason that these positions have been chosen is that they're the ones that not only were Republican leaders in the state looking for, so were Republican leaders nationally. I mean, Kemp took a lot of pressure prior to the announcement of this about who was being chosen, a lot of commentary about whether or not she was, once her name was floated, about whether or not she was a real Republican, et cetera. I think we sort of see that in the sense of her wanting to distance herself a little bit of the positions taken by the WNBA as opposed to her sort of personal positions and where that is. And it's a tough road to follow. I mean, on some level, she was jumping in really to kind of a quagmire that was not at all of her making and that she kind of got stuck into. But at the same time, I mean, I would imagine that she's saying things that she can't agree with and will stick with.
Sam, I recognize that I asked that question very unartfully. I think what I really wonder about is this tells you what the problem is when you're a brand new candidate with no record of any sort. I mean, there's some little bits and pieces of history that tell us some things about who she is. But when you've got nothing to back up the statements that you come out with as a brand new candidate, it's an odd place to be, I think.
So I've known Kelly for at least, if not longer than 12 years. I worked with her on several prior presidential campaigns, her and her husband, Jeff.
She was a big Mitt Romney supporter.
Yes. She is a farmer's daughter, as has been stated. She is exceedingly bright, exceedingly nice. She will be more of a Paul Coverdale, Johnny Isaacson senator than what we generally see in D.C., she will reach across the aisle to actually solve substantive issues. As you know, she was CEO of a cryptocurrency company. I doubt there's that many senators who understand what cryptocurrency is. You can cover any issue with her, and she will immediately fully understand it and be able to work on legislation to actually move the subject forward. And it doesn't have to be in a partisan role. So we're talking about initial partisan comments, but similar to Paul Coverdell, similar to Johnny Isakson, I think the interesting issue is going to be watching her in substantive legislation, and she is clearly up to the task.
And maybe that's another way to put it is that, like, we have a tendency to sort of focus on campaign statements, but at the end of the day, no one's ever going to get 100% of the policy that they want. And so the question is, what do you do in the negotiations when you're trying to figure out, right, what actually is going to happen and what's going to get you to getting a majority both in, right, your chamber as well as the other one and getting signed by the president? And a lot of times there is wiggle room within there, and I think that's going to be the question.
That's Michael. She really – well, she does, in fact – have to do everything she can to head off a challenger like Doug Collins from the right. So, I mean, she is saying what she needs to say, I would think, to try to make Republicans in Georgia comfortable with her.
Well, I've not met her, so I can't comment on anything personal in terms of my own understanding as to who she is. And I only know what I've read in the media. So I will step back and look at it just from a political perspective. She will be challenged from the right. And one of the things we do know, that Donald Trump demands absolute loyalty, and so do his followers, whether you support him or not. That's just a reality. And I just think it's an absolute certainty, if not Doug Collins, there will be one, if not more, hard right candidates trying to win that Senate seat. In the primary, in the jungle primary.
Right. And to Michael's point, I think you have to look at the timing. She gave her first sit-down interview to Greg Bluestein of the AJC.
Apparently it was a phone interview.
Okay, it was a phone. Okay, it was a phone interview.
And he was surprised to get the call.
Right. But it was about the same time that you saw Doug Collins on national TV, on every outlet around for several hours as the manager of the Republican side in Wednesday's impeachment hearings. So you're kind of up against that image, and you have to make it very clear to your Republican base that you're just as tough on impeachment as he is.
I think that makes great sense, Amy.
Yeah, well, and to Michael's point, I mean, what almost was most fascinating about this entire process was to see how there were other supporters of President Trump who, you know, after the announcement was made, suggested, for example, oh, well, now Kemp is going to have a challenger, right, that will come for you, that will come for those that you're supporting. And so there really is this it's been fascinating to watch sort of in that sense of the tribalness and also of sort of not thinking, to be perfectly blunt. This is, you know, politically and strategically thinking this is a better choice than Doug Collins for Brian Kemp to have made, based upon data and demographics and things like that.
Sam, you want to get the last word before our break?
So I know Doug Collins. I like Doug Collins. He's very sharp. He's got a great political career in front of him. He's clearly one of the leading Republicans in the House of Representatives.
As a Democrat, I'm just disappointed in this effort by Republicans to engage in identity politics.
Okay, so getting back to substance.
Because that's what Democrats always criticize, right? Identity politics, dealing with gender and race and demographics and so forth. And I agree. We should just have candidates running for office based on their qualifications, regardless as to gender or race or where they might reside or not.
All right, you want to finish that statement?
No, he blew the moment. Well, let's go forward.
This is kind of like bad buddy movie.
Did you guys each have something particularly potent for breakfast? You usually come in here and are so lovely with each other today.
No, how many times have you
I'm being nice.
No, it's not about
he's
Sam.
He's getting closer to re-election.
No, it's not about Sam.
I just got to say, who's Felix and who's Oscar?
But how many times have you heard Democrats being criticized for engaging in identity politics? That's all I'm asking.
Okay. Sam Mullins, you did not get the last word before the break. This is Political Rewind. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to Political Rewind. Jim Galloway, just a quick diversion for a minute. We talked a lot about Kelly Loeffler a few minutes ago. When are we going to see some Democrats jump into that race number two. We've got Matt Lieberman. He's the only one out there.
Well, you know, on Monday we had Jen Jordan here.
Yep. Yep. Didn't ask her.
Didn't ask her, but she dropped a pretty big hint. I don't know if you noticed it or not.
I'm not sure. What did she say?
She was noting that redistricting is coming up in Georgia. And in her district, you know, she's got Buckhead and kind of stretching up into Smyrna and Sandy Springs. It would be very easy to cut her out of her district. Hmm. That's often a decision that kind of leads to people deciding to jump into larger races. And then, of course, there's the CEO of DeKalb County.
Yeah,
I think we need to kind of.
I was going to be a little subtler. I was going to say, so, Michael, what are you hearing from your Democratic friends about who might run for seat number two?
Not much, actually. But, no, I'm excited by the opportunity. We will have highly qualified candidates in both Senate number one and two. This is going to be an exciting year, and I have no reservations or doubts that Democrats will fare well in 2020.
So we kid about this a lot, especially with you, because we've known each other forever.
Yeah.
But are you considering making the race? Is it fair to ask you that question today?
I've been approached by multiple sources on multiple occasions. And I'll repeat what I continue to say. I love the job I'm doing in DeKalb County. We're making tremendous progress on multiple fronts. But Jim Galloway has interrupted me, so I'll stop and let Jim.
Okay, all right. Well, let me ask you this. Okay, in the 6th District congressional race, mm-hmm. we have seen Republicans kind of go in and gently push out every other Republican candidate except for Karen Handel. Okay. To increase their chances, it's an insurance move. Okay, are we going to see Democrats say in late February, before March qualifying, are we going to see Democrats kind of call a convocation of people who are interested in this job, and kind of go through and see if they can narrow the field a little bit?
Well, absolutely.
In both Senate races, one and two.
Well, to your point, Jim, and I may be one of the few people, but I think it's been a very positive sign for the Democratic Party in Georgia, a sign of maturation, that you hadn't had scores of Democrats jumping into this race because the higher calling or whoever my mother-in-law told me to get in. This is, to me, an indication that Democrats are being more strategic, that we're being more serious about it. And I believe that at the end of the day, we will have a more positive outcome. When you've lost for 20 straight years, you have to really just step back. It's not what Mike wants. You know, that I'm past that stage. And I won the U.S. Senate nomination in Georgia before. I already got the plaque on the wall. It's not about being the nominee. It's about how do we best position the party, the resources, the voters, so that we can have a positive outcome in 2020.
All right. We'll watch and see who decides to step into that.
When's qualifying?
Race.
It's generally the first week of March. Now, we don't know. We don't absolutely know when qualifying is for Senate race number two.
That's right. Yep. It can be much later.
That's kind of up in the air.
Yeah.
Later.
All right. We're running short. We still have a good amount of time, but not enough time to get to all the subjects that I'd hope we would. So I want to give you all a choice. Would you rather talk about last night's Democratic presidential debate a little bit? Would you rather talk a little bit about Georgians who participated in that marathon impeachment debate on Wednesday? Your choice. What do you think, guys?
Is there a third option?
No.
Well, number one, I would say it's always a mistake to put together the words wine and cave in any kind of context.
All right. You chose it. We're going to talk a little about the presidential debate. It was fascinating last night, Jim, that Pete Buttigieg, 37 years old, mayor of South Bend, Indiana, married gay man, became the focus of most of the attacks that went on during the debate, which tells us that he's having success, certainly in Iowa, creeping up in the polls in national polling. So, you just made an interesting comment about wine caves. Let's play the exchange that Buttigieg had with Elizabeth Warren on that very subject.
The mayor just recently had a fundraiser that was held in a wine cave full of crystals and served $900 a bottle wine. Think about who comes to that. He had promised that every fundraiser he would do would be open door, but this one was closed door. We made the decision many years ago that rich people in smoke-filled rooms would not pick the next president of the United States. Billionaires in wine caves should not pick the next president of the United States.
This is the problem with issuing purity tests you cannot yourself pass. If I pledged never to be in the company of a progressive Democratic donor, I couldn't be up here. Senator, your net worth is 100 times mine.
I do not sell access to my time. I don't do call time with millionaires and billionaires.
Sorry, as of when, Senator? Senator, your presidential campaign right now, as we speak, is funded in part by money you transferred, having raised it at those exact same big ticket fundraisers you now denounce. Did it corrupt you, Senator? Of course not.
It was a great exchange, Jim.
It was. If number one, if only people were watching.
Yeah.
This was on PBS, and we do have the holidays coming down on top of us like a ton of bricks. So and it came right after the impeachment exhausted pretty much everybody in the nation.
So Amy, Buttigieg, he did pretty darn well. I mean, as Jim says, when you start out by smearing somebody about billionaires and wine cellars, pretty hard to recover. And perhaps, I mean, I can already see the meme. I mean, if he should win the nomination, Republicans are going to have a field day with $900 bottles of wine in wine caves. But what did you think when you heard the way Buttigieg acquitted himself in that exchange and the rest of the night?
I was really struck after the debate in many ways by the sort of two very different visions that people had of it. And I think some of it goes to sort of that exchange, goes to some of the other exchanges that and maybe sort of gets culminated in some that final question, which was, you know, do you have something that you want to apologize for, or do you have somebody that you want to give a gift to? And the two women on the stage apologized partly for, you know, at times being, I guess, verbal about things and maybe, you know, being perceived as angry, and the men wanted to give gifts. And so it was really interesting because for a lot of people, the takeaway was sort of this real divide between what was going on. I found it really fascinating how different people perceived of that exact same exchange, and that, you know, at least if you sort of read the commentary online, a lot of the men thought that Pete Buttigieg sounded great, whereas a lot of the women thought that he was very condescending and that he was only attacking the women. He was sort of, you know, in the same issues where he could have gone after, that he was kind of refusing to respond back. And so it was really sort of interesting to see it, because it was almost as though there were two very different debates going on, or at least two very different perceptions.
Well, I picked that out. There are so many things we could talk about, and with very little time, I don't want to leave the impression that was the only thing that mattered. I do think there was an important moment, Mike Thurman, and that was when Andrew Yang said, "I'm sorry, I'm the only person of color on this stage." He said, "I miss Kamala Harris. I miss Cory Booker." He said, "I think Cory will be back." But he raises an important point that I know Democrats are concerned about right now, after all of that's gone on so far.
You mean his identity politics?
It's increasingly, you know. Your touché. Turn, Mr. Thurmond.
Obviously, that was the concern of Perez, our national chair, because African-American voters and people of color play a huge role in our electorate throughout the nation. But the bigger issue for me with the debate and even with the primary, there are many of us who are very concerned that at the end of the day, does this help or hurt our effort to remove Donald Trump from office. Yeah.
And well, Sam, and of course, that the very argument that Joe Biden has made from the very first day that he's launched his campaign and released a video essentially saying that I'm the one person who can beat Donald Trump.
Right. And, you know, this may surprise someone or not surprise someone, but I continue to be very impressed by the mayor. I think he comes across as very sharp, very thoughtful. I think his proposals are actually ones that can pass Congress versus Senator Warren's, who's in an alternate universe. And I think in general, he comes across as someone you wouldn't mind having a beer with. Which is important.
Jim, we've got about 15 seconds. I'd like to give you the last comment.
Okay, number one, I'd say Joe Biden had a pretty darn good night.
Yeah.
Amy Klobuchar had a decent night as well. Elizabeth Warren was asked about her age, and she had this Ronald Reagan-like reply answer. Yeah, she says, she says, I will be the youngest woman ever elected president.
Terrific response. We are completely out of time for today's show. Thank you, Amy Steigerwald, Sam Olens, Michael Thurman, Jim Galloway. I know you're heading off for vacation, so
homecation.
We are right. We won't see you after today for a couple weeks, but all of us will be back on Monday at 2. See you then.